Rados will also be doing some transmission, I understand, for Bloomberg, yes? Mr. Rubini?
Good morning, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be back here to this forum. I was here a year ago. It's a very interesting and fascinating country, great city, so it's an honor to be here and be able again to present some of my views about the global economy. I'm going to talk about what's going on in the global economy, then I'm going to focus about what's going on in Europe and the Eurozone, and I'll say also some things about this region of the world and, of course, about Romania as well, and try to give you a broad perspective about how I see the economic outlook. Now, if I had to characterize the global economy today, I would characterize it as a glass that is half full and is half empty. There are many positive trends in the global economy, and things are going in the right direction, but there are also plenty of challenges and downside the risk and vulnerabilities. So it's a mixture of the two. And if one were to look at the headlines in the newspapers for the last few months, in some sense, there's been more of headlines about some of the risks and the bad news. You know, the year started with rising food and oil and commodity prices. Then we got these turmoil and uprisings in the Middle East. Then we got this terrible earthquake in Japan. Then we had renewed concerns about problems in the periphery of the Eurozone, Ireland losing market access and needing IMF bailout, Portugal losing market access, needing IMF EU bailout, and now renewed concerns about what's going to happen in Greece, whether there's going to be an orderly debt restructuring or not. Then there have been concerns about what's going on in the United States, large budget deficit, a fight about government shutdown, now a fight about debt ceiling with a risk of a technical even default on the public debt, worries about economic growth in the US. In the last couple of weeks, there have been also renewed concerns about global economic growth, slowdown in the US, slowdown in Europe, still economic contraction in the periphery of the Eurozone, Japan entering a recession, even data from China suggesting a slowdown in global economic growth. And while markets until recently were buoyant, and we're going up and risk was on, for the last couple of weeks now, markets have started to go south and people are becoming more nervous. There's more risk, more uncertainty, more volatility, more risk aversion, and now market correction, and from risk on, we're back to the risk off mode. So of course, we can worry about these things and I'm gonna talk about each one of them, but we should not lose perspective that also there are many positive things occurring in the global economy. So I'll talk about the positives, and of course, then I'm going to discuss the things could go wrong as opposed to the things can go right. If you want to emphasize the part of the glass that is half full, I will make the following observation. The first one is that there is a global economic recovery after a very severe recession and financial crisis. We prevented this great recession from turning into even worse, a great depression. And first there was an economic recovery, and now it's becoming an economic expansion, as in many countries, not all of them, the level of output in GDP now is above the pre-crisis level. And so there is economic growth, both in advanced economies and emerging markets. That's one positive. The second positive of the global economy is that some of the tail risk we were worrying about a year ago, the risk of outright deflation in advanced economies, the risk of a double dip recession in US and other advanced economies, the risk of a total collapse of the Eurozone and breakup of the Eurozone, like May of last year. Those risks today have a lower probability than a year ago. Not zero probability, but lower probability. If anything now, we've moved away from worrying about the deflation, about whether we should worry about rising inflation or not. So even the tail risks that we think about are different today than what they were a year ago. And that's a positive, some of those tail risks are now smaller, not zero probability, but smaller. The third positive about the global economy is that the balance sheets and the P&Ls of high-grade corporates in advanced economies are now strong. These corporations took the occasion of the crisis to slash costs, especially labor costs. Of course, that was extremely painful, job losses, rising unemployment rate, But now they become, as they say, lean and mean, highly productive, highly efficient, highly profitable. Profits and earnings have been surprising quarter after quarter on the upside. And this corporation now are sitting on a pile of cash, several trillion dollars. And if they become more confident about the recovery, they have the financial resources to spend more on capital spending, spend more on job hiring, spend more on M&A activity, financial transactions. And of course, there is an open question of whether they're going to spend more in slow-growing advanced economies as opposed to faster-growing emerging markets, but certainly it's a positive. You know, the balance sheet of households are still damaged. The balance sheet of banks and many financial institutions is still damaged or barely recovering. The balance sheets of state and local governments and of central governments is also damaged, but there is one balance sheet that is the one of the high-grade corporate sector that looked like sound, so that could be one of the engines of a recovery in advanced economies. The fourth positive about the global economy is the rising economic, financial, and trading power of emerging market economies. This is not just cyclical, it's a secular phenomenon. Their growth rate potential and actual is much higher than advanced economies. And a greater share of global GDP and its growth rate is going to be accounted by emerging markets. This is not just a story about China or India or emerging Asia. It's also a story for many parts of Latin America. It's also a story for some parts of Central Eastern Europe. Not every economy is strong, but some of them are stronger, and some of those who were in trouble are now recovering. It's a good story also about parts of Central Asia. Even in sub-Saharan Africa, there are some good growth stories. And even in the Middle East, where the headlines, of course, have been about the turmoil and the uprising, there's a huge amount of wealth, oil wealth and energy wealth in the Gulf that can be used at productive use for growth in their own region, in the North Africa and the rest of the Middle East, and also through foreign direct investment all the way to Central Europe and other parts of the world. So the fact that emerging markets are still strong and resilient, most of them is a positive for the global economy. We'll have many engines, locomotives, and poles of economic growth as opposed to the traditional one of US, Europe, and Japan. An additional kind of positive for the global economy derives from what had happened until recently in financial markets. You remember last year was a year of risk on and risk off for financial markets. Risk was off during the spring of last year where there was the Greek crisis. Risk was off in the summer where people were worried about the US double dip recession. But by the fall, between the US doing another round of quantitative easing, US doing another fiscal stimulus of $1 trillion of tax cuts, and the Europeans for the time being patching up the problems of the periphery through bailout money, the year ended actually with a rally in risky assets, starting with global equities and a compression in credit spreads, high yield and high grade corporate bonds. So risk was on and risk aversion was falling. And that's positive because, of course, if the economy surprises on the upside and there is asset prices going up and asset inflation and credit spreads are falling, then wealth effects feed back to the real economy. And you can have a positive virtuous circle of rising asset prices, rising economies, as opposed to the vicious circle of falling asset prices and falling economies that we experienced between 2007 and 2009. And the more the balance sheet repair occurs on the asset side with asset inflation, the less of it has to occur through a painful process of spending less, saving more, to deleverage and reduce debt. So that's why the asset inflation is important. And in some sense, the fact that the recovery is more resilient today is also signaled by the fact that if you think about last year the problem of a small economy like Greece that was only 3% of the Eurozone GDP led to a market correction that between the spring and summer was almost 20% of global equity markets, not just in Greece, not just in the Eurozone, not just US, even emerging markets had a 20% correction. This year you have had potentially much bigger shock, oil and food prices, the Middle East, Japan, trouble of the Eurozone again, US. So far until recently, the markets were resilient, the markets were shrugging off this risk. Of course, in the days of the panic about Japan, or the Middle East, or the US fiscal government shutdown, markets were down, but then they went up again. Volatility was up and then went down again. But for most of the year, until a couple of weeks ago, actually, investors seemed to be resilient, having less risk aversion, more appetite for risk, and they were trying to, you know, to discount some of this tail risk, and markets were going up rather than going down. In the last few weeks, things have become more fragile for reasons we're going to discuss, but certainly one way of thinking about what happened until recently was that people believe that the recovery this year is more resilient than a year ago. That's why they were more willing to discount some of the negative news and let market prices rise further. So these are the positives, and I think we should recognize them. And there are positives, you know, for the countries that were already in good shape, like most emerging markets, and also positives for advanced economies that got into a recession, or even emerging markets like Romania and other in the region that had financial fragility, but through good and hard work now are starting to see an economic recovery, however tentative that recovery might be. So there is economic recovery, there is economic expansion, in spite of the risk we're facing. What are the things we should worry about in the global economy? You know, I've listed them, and if I had to summarize them, and I'm going into some detail. One is the weak recovery of advanced economies. The second problem is sovereign risk in most advanced economies as you have rising debt and deficits. Three, the problems of the periphery of the Eurozone. Four, the downside risk to US economic growth, that is still a recovery is fragile. Five, the risk that overheating in most emerging markets might cause inflation to become a bigger problem and lead eventually to a hard landing rather than a soft landing. Additional problem is what's happening in the Middle East with oil prices rising, increasing inflation and reducing economic growth. Seven problem is the risk deriving from what happened to Japan and its own spillovers to the region, Asia, and to global economy. And the eighth problem is what's going to happen when the monetary and the fiscal stimulus is going to go away, because it started to go away. Is there enough resilience in private demand to maintain growth in a world where there is still a huge amount of uncertainty and volatility and risk? Every other day, there is a new tail risk or black swan event or things from the far field that hits the global economy. And we've seen surprises of one sort or another, from Middle East to Japan to other ones. So those are the kind of things that you have to worry about. Let me speak about some of these things that are the downside risk in some more detail. First observation is that the economic recovery in advanced economies, as I pointed out even a year ago, is more like a U, anemic, subpar, below trend, as opposed to a V, as in a typical recovery from a recession. The recovery has been more of a V in the emerging market economies that have sound macro and financial fundamentals, but even in the emerging markets that got in trouble, those, for example, in Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe that had economic and financial and fiscal fragility, recovery is also a U, for example. There is a recovery in Romania, but this year is going to be well below trend. So it's a U recovery for both the advanced economies and those emerging markets that had economic and financial pressures and fiscal problems and other issues of debt and leverage to address. So the recovery in most advanced economies is weak, and it's going to remain weak for a number of years because there is a painful process of balance sheet repair and deleveraging. You have to spend less in the private and public sector. You have to save more in order to reduce debt. And as you save more and spend less, in the short run, that has a negative effect on economic growth. Positive growth, but slow growth, mediocre growth. And growth has been mediocre in Europe, in US, in Japan, in most advanced economies, with very few exceptions. So that's the first issue. The second problem with the global economy is that the problem of sovereign risk is a serious problem, not just in the periphery of the Eurozone. Of course, the bond market vigilantes have already woken up in Greece, in Ireland, in Portugal, in Italy, in Spain. They've not yet woken up in the US or in Japan or United Kingdom, but let's not forget budget deficit of 10% of GDP in US, Japan, and so on. Public debt at current trend is going to rise for advanced economies as a whole, IMF estimates, from 70% of GDP before the crisis to over 100% of GDP on average for advanced economies in the next 2 or 3 years. And some countries, of course, like Greece and others, are already well above 100% of GDP. And if we don't do something about this deficit, eventually the bond market vigilantes could also wake up in Japan or the United States. And of course, in addition to the official debt, there are also implicit liabilities of government coming from aging of population in US, Europe, and Japan. Social security and pension system that are unfunded or only partially funded, and the rising cost of healthcare for the elderly as you have aging of population. So you have official debt and then you have contingent or implicit debt as well that makes the fiscal situation fragile. So most advanced economies have a problem, not just the periphery of the Eurozone. The third problem on which I want to spend actually a significant amount of time is the problems of the periphery of the Eurozone. These countries from Greece to Portugal to Ireland to Italy to Spain, but some people are even raising concerns now about Belgium and other economies in the Eurozone. Now, you cannot lump them all together. Each one of them has differences, so you have to study them individually. But there are also some things that are common to all of them. So I'll talk about some of the commonalities and common challenges. And then, of course, you have to be more specific. You cannot put them all into the same basket. For example, Italy on the fiscal side today is in better shape than the rest of the periphery of Eurozone. Have done more to try to reduce their own kind of fiscal risk. So it's important to make those caveats. But if I have to say something about the problems they're facing, first of all of them to different degrees have large budget deficits and large stocks of public debt is rising. And that's one thing that we know has led then to a fiscal crisis and a sovereign debt problems and loss of market access already in three countries, Greece first, then Portugal and Ireland. Second issue is that these countries also have still fragile, some of them banking systems, especially those that had a housing and real estate bubble when bust, like Ireland and Spain. But also the other countries have either some fraction of bad loans because the economy had a recession and the economy is weak, not just loans to construction. And many of these countries' banking system have also a lot of exposure to the sovereign. As we know, the sovereign has a lot of deficits and debt. And therefore, you know, the banking risk became a sovereign risk because we socialized the losses in a number of these countries. But now sovereign risk can become banking risk because if the sovereign is in distress and the banks hold a lot of the government debt, then the sovereign risk eventually goes back to the banking system. So these banks have bad assets. They don't have sufficient capital, some of them. Some of their bad liabilities may have to be restructured. And therefore, there is still credit contraction or weak economic credit growth. And therefore, recovery is going to be very anemic. And in some cases, output is still falling. So you have to clean up the financial system, do another round of serious stress tests, and fix it. You don't have only public debt and deficit. You have also private debt and deficits. Because you know, many of the foreign liabilities of these countries are not the liabilities of the government, but also of the households, of the banks, of the financial system, of the corporate sector, because they were running large trade deficits that were being financed with inflows of capital from abroad. So you have to roll over public debt and deficits, but you have also to roll over private debts as well that are owed to non-residents and foreigners. That's a third issue. These are countries also that lost competitiveness for over a decade. Already 10 years ago, this country were losing export shares and market shares to China, to Asia, to Central Europe, to Turkey, because their exports tend to be labor-intensive and low value-added. And it's much more cheap, of course, to produce labor-intensive goods like textiles, apparel, leather, and other products in, you know, in Asia or in Central Eastern or Southern Europe than it is in the periphery of the Eurozone. So that was one source of the loss of competitiveness. Then, for a decade, wages in these countries were growing more than productivity. Unit labor costs were rising. Real exchange rate based on these unit labor costs were appreciating. And that was the loss of competitiveness that manifested itself in large and growing current account deficits. And the final nail in the coffin was the very sharp appreciation of the euro that did occur between 2002 and until now. So you have a problem of competitiveness and large external deficit. And the final problem this country is facing is that either economic growth is negative or is barely positive. So still contraction in Greece, in Ireland, in Portugal, and barely positive economic growth in Italy and Spain. So how are you going to fix all this problem? Restore growth, restore competitiveness, reduce private and public debt, and rolling them over. Clean up the financial system, do fiscal austerity, structural reform, and achieve sustained economic growth that is necessary to make all the sacrifices socially and politically acceptable. It's going to be a chronic problem that at best is going to take many, many years to resolve. Now, in the specific, there are some countries at this point that are not just illiquid, they are insolvent. And let me take the specific case of Greece, because of course it's relevant. Even if Greece was to do everything in the IMF EU program, and that's a draconian 10% of GDP fiscal adjustment, so even if Greece was implementing 100% the IMF EU program, the public debt of Greece in a matter of 2 years is going to be, in the best scenario, at 160% of GDP. That's the best scenario. In a more likely scenario, it's going to be 170 or 180. Just to give you a matter of comparison, Argentina and Russia defaulted on their public debt when it was 50% of GDP. In Greece, in the best scenario, it's going to be 160, so more than three times as high as Argentina and Russia. So in the case of Greece, the issue is not whether the country is insolvent or not. The debt ratio cannot be stabilized, cannot be reduced, even if Greece was to do everything. And therefore, the issue is not whether or if there's going to be an orderly debt restructuring, but when it's going to occur and how it's going to occur. And here is important, by the way, to be very specific, because some people, including the European Central Bank, are really misspeaking. Many people talk about default, and that's actually a wrong word to use, because in most of the episodes of distress of a sovereign, with few exceptions, it was not a default. The way a restructuring occurs and a restructuring and a reprofiling of the debt is a very different phenomenon from a default. Default did occur in Russia or Ecuador, Argentina, but default did not occur in dozens of other episodes of sovereign debt. You can do an orderly, market-oriented, and market-friendly debt restructuring, where you exchange, before a default, all debt for new debt that has new financial features. And the examples that are more relevant of an orderly, market-oriented, market-friendly restructuring are the Brady Plan of the early 1990s, where the debt problems of Latin America were restructured orderly. And the examples in the last few years of an orderly debt restructuring in Pakistan, in Ukraine, in Uruguay, in the Dominican Republic, in Belize, and many other countries. And what's important about this restructuring is that in all of these options, the restructuring occurred with what is referred to as a par bond, meaning a new bond whose face value was not lower than the previous bond, so you don't have any haircut or official losses on the face value of your debt. You give new bonds with the same face value, but since there is a maturing problem, you push the maturities out of that debt by 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, whatever is necessary. And you can also reduce the interest rate on that debt, certainly below current market rates that are unsustainable, and possibly below the original coupon, so you reduce and you provide some debt relief. Now, these are not default episodes. These are orderly, market-friendly, market-oriented restructuring. And for the purposes, by the way, of CDS triggering, if you do it this way, it doesn't even trigger the CDSs. So rating agencies might think of it as being a credit event, but for the purpose of CDSs, it's not a credit event. These things have been done successfully, orderly, with little or no contagion in dozens of episodes of emerging market crisis. And especially if you're worried about banks or insurance companies or pension funds that are keeping their debt of Greece today in their hold-to-maturity bucket or their banking book rather than a trading book, one way to avoid contagion and damage to banks in Greece, in the core of the Eurozone and other parts of the Eurozone is exactly to have this par bond option, an option where the face value of the debt is not reduced but is pushed out in terms of maturity and a reduction of the interest rates. Because these banks and financial institutions that today, through a regulatory fudge, are already allowed to keep the debt at 100 cents on the dollar on their books because it's in the banking book, even if the market value of Greek debt today is around 65 cents on the dollar, after an orderly debt restructuring would be still allowed to hold this debt at face value. So people worry about contagion, and the ECB has been increasingly shrill, and shrill is actually an understatement, in talking about a disaster, the financial Armageddon, a massive contagion, collapse of the banking system in Greece, and other nonsense, speaking about the debt restructuring. And the reality is different. You know, I've written a 20-page paper a couple of weeks ago about orderly restructuring of Greek debt and how you can do it orderly. I wrote another piece just this past week, 20 pages, discussing 7 potential channels of contagion from an orderly debt restructuring in Greece to other banks and sovereigns in Europe, whether it's in Greece or in Portugal or Ireland or Spain or Italy. The reality is, when you look at the data, when you look at the history, the reality is that actually the risk of contagion are minimal, are modest, are manageable, are preventable if you do an orderly debt restructuring. So the reckless thing is to talk about default. They talk always about default, and it's not talk about default, it's about orderly debt restructuring. They talk about massive contagion and financial collapse. And these words actually is playing with fire, because if the ECB is worried about avoiding a bank run in Greece, talking loud about these things and saying that the ECB is going to refuse accepting as collateral restructured debt, and there's no reason why the ECB should not accept debt that has been fairly restructured as collateral. The debt of Greece today is rated as junk, and the new debt is going to be better and better performing than the old debt. So these things actually risk causing the kind of a bank run that the ECB says they're worried about. So the increasingly shrill and reckless statements by ECB board members and others are actually dangerous, because they make the financial condition of the banks in Greece and the sovereign worse, as opposed to be a constructive player in what could be an orderly restructuring of the public debt of Greece. So actually the words are not only wrong and incorrect, because they don't know history and they haven't seen, and they talk about stuff they don't know about, honestly speaking, but they're actually dangerous and reckless. That's the situation we have right now, which actually the official sector is damaging the prospects for an orderly debt restructuring. So these things have been done, have done in the past, they've been done orderly. The contagion and the damage to Greek banks, to other European banks, the risk of contagion to other countries in the Eurozone is limited. Portugal and Ireland have already lost market access. They govern their banks, so there cannot be contagion to them. And whatever is going to happen to Spain or Italy or Belgium is going to depend on whether this country follows sound policies. If this country follows sound policies, there's not going to be contagion and they're not going to lose market access. And if they don't follow sound policies, then they're going to lose market access regardless of whether Greece restructure is debt or not. Restructuring of debt of Greece is totally irrelevant for what's going to happen in Spain. Ireland and Portugal lost market access even if Greece did not restructure its debt. And they lost market access because their fiscal and financial fundamentals were wrong. So what is going to happen potentially in Spain or any other parts of the Eurozone depends on what these countries are doing. And the example of many economies in Central Eastern Europe is, if you do fiscal adjustment, if you do reform, if you get official help, you can dig yourself out of your hole, like Romania has done now, Hungary and other countries. So if you do the right thing, you're going to get out of your problem. And if you don't do the right things, it doesn't matter what Greece does or doesn't do, as totally independent. So there is a lot of talk about contagion, about another financial Armageddon. But the reality is that actually, especially if you do a market-oriented, market-friendly debt restructuring, those risks are highly containable, and I have a long paper in which I discuss in detail, step by step, why that risk of contagion is vastly overstated and is based not on factual analysis of the data and evidence, but just on statements that have no empirical grounding whatsoever. So the point is, an orderly restructuring of Greece has to occur, and the alternative is going to be worse. Giving more official money to Greece is not going to resolve its problem, and it's going to end up being the mother of all bailouts and the mother of all moral hazard plays. Greece is already off track in their program today compared to what it was, and not because they've not done fiscal effort. They've done a huge amount of fiscal effort, but that fiscal effort has made the recession worse, and therefore revenues are falling. So you have this vicious circle right now. That's why Plan A is failing. Greece is not going to regain market access next year or the following year, and there's a huge financing gap. So there are only two options. Either you do an orderly restructuring of the public debt of Greece, or otherwise you have to increase vastly the official bailout. The 110 billion euros are not going to be enough, and you're going to eventually have to buy the entire debt of Greece and then finance for the next 10 years any flow deficit of Greece. So on top of the 110 billion euros of the current IMF EU program, you'll have to give them another 200 to 300 billion euros to buy up all their debt and finance their deficit for as far as I can see. That to me is the mother of all moral hazards, is the mother of all bailouts, and is not going to resolve any situation in Greece. An orderly restructuring and bail-in of private creditors, 10, 120, and eventually it's going to break the back of that government, and it's going to cause a sovereign debt crisis, and it's going to prevent that sovereign from being able to backstop his own banks. A more rational thing would have been to take the senior debt of the bank, convert it into equity, reduce it, and therefore keep the banks into private hands and recapitalize the banks through the traditional debt into equity conversion, rather than putting all that junk on the balance sheet of the government and now causing eventually a financial and a sovereign crisis. So that's a mistake, but that's the route that so far Ireland has taken. Portugal has not even started Plan A. They're just starting the IMF program. I think they'll have the same challenges of Greece to reduce deficits while restoring growth. That's going to be a mission impossible. To restore competitiveness when the euro is becoming stronger rather than weaker. And therefore, Plan A is going to fail step by step in most of these countries, and then you'll have to move Plan B. And Plan B is an orderly debt restructuring, not more bailouts, because that doesn't make sense. You know, the big elephant in the room is, of course, Spain, a country is too big to fail and too big to be saved. There are some positives in Spain coming from fiscal adjustment, from more reforms, from higher savings rates, lower budget deficits, and lower stock of public debt. But there are also many negatives. High unemployment rate, the fallout of a severe housing bust, the loss of competitiveness of the Spanish economy in the years where wages were growing more than productivity. The losses of the banking system will have to be recapitalized, political fragility. So things can go either way in Spain. Spain could avoid losing market access if they accelerate reforms, but could also lose market access. And losing market access and needing an IMF EU program is going to be independent of whether Greece restructure is that or not. So there is plenty of fragilities in the periphery of the Eurozone. As I said, the problems are chronic. They're going to take many years to resolve. But the combination of right policies are a combination of policy adjustment. It is fiscal austerity, privatization, structural reforms. They include also provision, when necessary, of official money. But they also include, when market access is not regained and debt remains unsustainable, an orderly restructuring of public debt and also private liabilities of the banking system. That third element has been so far avoided, but has to be put on the table. Has to be put on the table because if you have an unsustainable debt problem, there are only limited ways to resolve it. And you cannot take private debts and then socialize the losses and they become public debt. And then those public debt, when countries lose market access, lead to a bailout by supernationals, IMF, ECB, EFSF, and so on. So you go from private debt to public debt to supernational debts. You know, nobody is going to come from Mars or the moon to bail out the IMF or the ECB. So kicking the can down the road and creating a bigger and more heavy debt problem is not the right way to do it. If you cannot grow yourself out of a debt problem, and you're not going to grow yourself out of a debt problem, because growth is going to remain anemic in these countries. And if you cannot save yourself out of a debt problem, because in the short run, spending less and saving more to reduce your debt causes the paradox of thrift, that the recession becomes worse. So if you cannot grow yourself or save yourself out of that problem, and if you cannot inflate yourself out of a debt problem because the ECB is not going to allow high inflation to erode the real value of private and public debt, then there is only one solution. You cannot grow yourself or inflate yourself or save yourself out of a debt problem. Then you need orderly debt restructuring and reduction when your debt ratios are unsustainable. That's the lesson. And if you try avoid it instead of an orderly restructuring, you're going to have a disorderly default. That's the difference between Argentina, that postponed a restructuring and ended up in nasty and ugly and destructive default, an example of Uruguay that the next year learned the lesson of Argentina, did the preemptive orderly debt exchange that avoided default and made this debt ratio sustainable. So you could end up into a disorderly thing if you prevent exactly what you want to prevent, this orderly restructuring. So that's the situation in Europe and the Eurozone, and it's still one of the biggest risks to the global economy and to financial markets. There was also economic and fiscal and financial trouble in a number of countries in Central, Eastern, and Southern Europe. Again, you cannot put them all into a basket together. Countries like Poland, Czech Republic, and others that are closer to Germany in terms of trade links did okay during the crisis. Countries that had twin deficits, like fiscal problems and current accounts problems and overvalued currencies and too much foreign currency liabilities, short-term liabilities of the government and or of the private sector, had financial pressure. The good news is that many of these countries made many sacrifices, from Hungary to Romania to Bulgaria to others. There was a very painful, of course, economic recession, but that fiscal austerity, the structural reforms are now starting to pay off, and there is a beginning of an economic recovery, driven initially by external demand and export growth, as there is global economic recovery in Germany does well, but slowly, slowly, with restoration of credit growth, also domestic demand, consumption, investment, and others, is going to become more positive. There is now capital inflows to a number of these economies, including Romania. So that is going in the right direction, and that's a positive. And of course, more reforms have to be done. Fiscal austerity has to be maintained. There is always the risk that, as in a number of these countries, there are elections coming up, then there's a pressure to spend more and go off track on the fiscal side. It's important to maintain that kind of a fiscal discipline to make sure that the stabilization of economy, of the markets, of investors' confidence remains. A number of these countries, of course, like the rest of the world, are facing also a rising inflation as oil and food prices are rising. And in the case of Romania, almost half of their consumption basket is food and energy. So that effect on domestic inflation has been more significant. And the increase last year, of course, in the value-added tax also added to that temporary increase in inflation. It's my view that some of that increase in inflation is temporary, as these base effects of rising taxes and food and oil prices are going to fizzle out, so inflation is going to become lower. So probably the current stance of monetary policy of keeping interest rates stable is the right one. If you raise rates too much, you could clip the wings of the recovery that is still tentative. You could have too much appreciation of the currency. Of course, some appreciation of the currency helps you on the inflation side, but it's a trade-off. You know, you need a weaker currency for growth, but you need a stronger currency for inflation. Of course, the fact that there is still a lot of foreign currency denominated debt warns about excessive movements down or up in the currency value. So things are, of course, still delicate, but they're going in the positive direction. And I think that for this region, you know, economic growth is going to continue, even if realistically, until more structural reforms are made, and until the global economy comes stronger, and until the fiscal condition improves further, economic growth is going to be modest, below trend, but gradually improving, you know, this year better than last year, and hopefully next year better than this year. So things are positive. Of course, the risk to the region come from if there is trouble in the Eurozone, if there is trouble in Greece, if there is trouble in the Middle East with rising oil and commodity prices. So the best you can do is to help yourself with your own sound policies. You don't have control on external shocks that can hit you, but the sounder are your domestic economic policies, the less likely is that waves of shocks and uncertainty from the rest of the world is going to have a greater negative impact than by having those sounder economic policies. So no country is an island. Everybody's ready to everybody else. The most important thing that every country can do is to have sound economic policies that maintain macro, financial, fiscal stability, and therefore then when shock occurs, the effects and the damaging contagion is going to be more modest and more limited than otherwise. So I see progress going in the right direction in Romania and in other countries in the region, even if, as we know, a number of the policy issues and the risk remain with us and going to remain with us, especially in a global economic outlook that's becoming increasingly more challenging than it was a few months ago. So those are the kind of issues I've used, as I see, for Europe, the Eurozone and Central Europe and the rest of the European Union. Let me briefly speak about a fourth downside risk to the global economy that comes from the United States. United States growth has been okay, but even last year was below trend, was a recovery, was anemic, 2.8%. This first quarter was even worse, 1.8%, and the second quarter, based on the recent data, doesn't look much better than the first quarter. The optimists talk about a soft patch, but I'm not sure if it's just a soft patch. We're seeing already globally slowdown of growth, not just in the US, but also in the Eurozone, in Japan, contraction in China. So we might be at the beginning, like the spring of last year, of another bout of risk aversion driven by economic growth becoming slower, and people are going to start to talk, if not about a double dip recession, about the risk of a stall speed or a growth recession. Now, what are the problems of the US? One is that oil prices are high, and that's a negative for growth. That's a problem for the US, but also for all other countries that are net energy importers, from Europe to Japan to China to India to most of Eastern Europe or Central Europe. Of course, it's a benefit for oil exporters. So the oil price is a negative for the economy. Secondly, the labor market is still weak. Unemployment rate is high. We're creating only as many jobs as the increase in the labor force, so the unemployment rate is not falling. Three, there's a part of the economy, US is already double dipping, that's the housing market, where prices and quantity that are still falling. The housing depression is not ended, unfortunately. That's a negative for the economy. Four, you have the problems of state and local governments, US are in trouble. Europe has the problem of Greece, Ireland, Portugal, you name it. US has the problem of Arizona, Nevada, Texas, Florida, New York, Maryland, Illinois, you name it. Five, you have the fiscal problem of the central government, of the federal government. At least the Europeans are trying to reduce their budget deficit. The US is kicking the can down the road. This year, not much progress on the deficit. Next year is an election year, nothing's gonna be done. And whoever is gonna be president in 2013, whether it's Obama or Republican, he or she is gonna inherit a budget for 2013, already decided in 2012. So whoever is gonna be president may be able to start doing something about the US fiscal deficit only in fiscal year 2014. So the US is kicking the can down the road. They're not addressing the fiscal problem because there is political gridlock. Republicans are against tax increases. Democrats are against spending cuts. And since you can borrow at low rates, the path of least resistance politically is to run deficits and kick the can down the road. And what's the risk that in the next 3 years, as we kick the can down the road, something's gonna snap in the bond market, and bond market vigilantes that have been in a coma or asleep at the wheel are gonna wake up, snap like in Europe, spike interest rates and threaten the recovery. It's a low risk now, but it's a rising risk as we are not resolving our fiscal problem. The final point I'll make on the US is the following one. Consumption growth has been okay for the last few quarters, not because labor income is growing. Before taxes and transfers, real wages are flat. What has been sustaining disposable income has been taxes and transfers. And we've just given to the US consumers another $1 trillion of income through reduction in taxes that has been paid with another $1 trillion of public debt. So the deleveraging of the households has been essentially slowed down by even more releveraging of the public sector to the tune of another $1 trillion deficit and debt. That means that if and when in the next year or two, the public sector will have to start spending less and raise taxes and make less transfer payments, that's gonna be a fiscal drag, but that's gonna force another round of adjustment of the consumers. So some of the growth of consumption and of the economy is stolen from the future, is essentially one that has been due to this re-leveraging of the public sector, preventing the public sector from doing more. So that's a risk from the United States. What are the final risks I would think about? One is emerging markets. Many of them, not in this region, but many in Asia or Latin America, are overheating, are growing more than potential. Inflation has been rising. There is excessive credit growth, asset bubble from real estate to other parts of the economy. Inflation is rising. Policy rates are below inflation rates. Central banks are behind the curve. They're not tightening enough. They're not letting their currency appreciate very much. And the risk is that if they fall further behind the curve, then eventually they'll have to tighten more when inflation is too high, and that might cause in Asia or China or even Latin America something closer to a hard landing rather than a soft landing. That's a risk that many of them are facing. So that's a fifth risk that I see to the global economy. The sixth risk to the global economy comes from Middle East and the effect on oil prices. If the turmoil becomes worse, all could go up another 10, 20%, and then you have a crowding out of the recovery and a double dip recession in many advanced economies, if all were to go back to $140 per barrel, like in 2008. Even if oil stays around $100 per barrel, that implies higher inflation and lower growth around the world. And the problem of inflation is big, serious in emerging markets that are overheating. In advanced economies, I think that headline inflation is going to rise, but core inflation is not going to go much higher. You'll have first round, but not second round effects from the oil and commodity prices. Why? You have a slack in goods markets and firms don't have pricing power. They cannot raise their prices as their costs go up. There's slack in labor markets with unemployment rate around 10%. Workers don't have wage bargaining power. Wages are growing less than productivity. Therefore, unit labor costs are falling. And since 70% of the cost of production are labor costs, you're not going to get wage inflation. So if you're not going to get wage and price inflation, the second round effects that lead to an increase in core inflation are going to be limited in advanced economies. In emerging markets, there is a risk that core headline and expected inflation becomes larger. So people are starting to worry about inflation. I would not worry about inflation in most advanced economies. As I said, in a number of emerging markets that depend a lot on oil food imports or that are growing too much, like in Asia, inflation could be a more serious issue. But for most advanced economies, not going to be the case. A couple of final points. One was on Japan. Japan has had this terrible earthquake. There could be global consequences. One, because of damage to global supply chain. Two, because now there is a reconsideration of whether, nuclear power is a safe and kind of clean source of energy. If people are going to rely less on nuclear in Germany, in China, in US, more demand for coal, more demand for oil, that's going to push higher price of oil, that's going to be a negative. There are question marks on how a country with 200% of GDP public debt and large deficit is going to finance its reconstruction. If there is taxes, they may crowd out the recovery. If they increase debt financing, they might lead to higher loan rates. If they repatriate private and public savings, that might strengthen the yen. This is going to be counterproductive for exports. So there are many questions coming from also what's happened in Japan and consequences for Japan, for Asia, and all the way to the United States. Japanese auto parts are used in the assembly of Japanese cars in transport plants in the United States. So the global supply chain has negative effects throughout the world. I'll make one final consideration about the downside risk. You know, at the beginning I said that the glass was half full, but it was half full in part because we had a massive amount of monetary liquidity injection in the global economy, right? Zero policy rates, QE1, QE2, credit easing, every conventional and unconventional liquidity support of the financial system, corporates, households, you name it, in US, in Europe, in Japan, in emerging markets. And on the fiscal side, we had massive fiscal stimulus during the crisis, 10% of GDP, fiscal deficits in US, in Europe, in Japan, and stimulus in many emerging markets. Now, the fiscal stimulus is starting to go away, in the Eurozone because the bond vigilantes are forcing you. It's going away in the UK because the government decided to do front-loaded fiscal adjustment. And even in the US, where we're kicking the can down the road, state and local governments are spending less, and even the federal government is going to spend less. And eventually, even the US will have to raise taxes, reduce transfer payments. And while fiscal austerity is necessary, because if you don't do it, you're going to have a fiscal train wreck, an IMF study suggests that the fiscal austerity in the short run has a negative effect on growth. You're raising taxes, reducing disposable income, reducing transfer payments, reducing spending. So however necessary in the short run, painful, austerity has a negative effect on growth. Look what's happening in Greece, in Ireland, in UK, in Spain. We have to do it, but has that negative effect. So the fiscal stimulus is going to become a drag on economic growth. How about monetary policy? The European Central Bank has already started to raise rates. That's going to damage the growth rate of the periphery. It's going to strengthen the euro. It's going to hurt even more the competitiveness of the periphery. There's fiscal problem, growth problem, financial sector problem, sovereign debt problem. The policy of the ECB of raising rates too much, too fast, too soon is going to be counterproductive. The Bank of England has not yet raised rates, but with inflation now well above target, may have to start raising rates in the next few months. And even the Fed is going to be more cautious. Is going to finish QE2 in June, but after the end of QE2, there is not going to be most likely QE3. There's not going to be QE3 because growth, however anemic, is positive, because inflation, however low, is rising, because Republicans in Congress are bashing the Fed, saying you are debasing the currency or risk doing so, and because three out of the four new members of the FOMC, Kochar Lakota, Plosser, and Fisher, are more hawkish than Ben Bernanke, Janet Yellen, and the central tendency of the FOMC. So even in the US, there's going to be discussion about exiting from monetary overhang, mopping up liquidity, and eventually raising rates. So the question I'll leave you is the following one. How much there is resilience in private demand, consumption, investment, exports, in a world in which monetary and fiscal stimulus that led to the recovery, however gradually, are going away, and from a monetary and fiscal stimulus, we'll have a monetary and a fiscal drag? Is there enough resilience in a world in which there is all these tail events and risk and uncertainties? There is volatility, uncertainty, and risk. It was macroeconomic, financial, and fiscal uncertainty, but today there is also political uncertainty, geopolitical uncertainty, policy uncertainty, and regulatory uncertainty. So until recently, the markets were shrugging off all these risks. They were ignoring the Middle East, they were ignoring oil and food prices, they were ignoring Japan, they were ignoring the Eurozone, they were ignoring the US fiscal deficit. For a few months, you know, this was the pattern. Maybe one day markets were down and then they were going up again. But I think that something has changed in the last few weeks. And what's changing is several things. One is that we're realizing that growth in the world is slowing down again. There is a risk of a stall speed. The data from the US, the data from the periphery of Eurozone, the data from the UK, the data from Japan, but also the data now from China. So I think that until now people believe there's going to be a strong recovery. Now it's becoming much softer, and not just in advanced economies. Even China is showing signs of a slowdown. Two, because of that slowdown in growth, risk aversion is becoming higher. It's not easy anymore to ignore these things. Three, the problems of the periphery of the Eurozone are becoming worse. They tried to kick the can down the road, but after Greece, Ireland, and Portugal lost market access, now Greece looks like an insolvency case. Plan A has failed, and there is even worries that Spain or Italy or Belgium might get in trouble. So it's not easy to ignore anymore what's happening in the Eurozone. Those of us who said this is not going to be a solution have been proven right, and that's a risk that now, of course, is bearing on the market. And the Middle East is still remaining in turmoil. Oil and commodity prices are still high. The damaging effect on growth and on inflation are things we see in the data. And therefore, markets have become more brittle, more fragile. And the markets were going up because until now, profits and profit margins and earnings and sales were surprising on the upside. But profit margins are going to start to get squeezed because cost of production are going higher, but firms are not able to increase their retail prices. And therefore, if your costs go up and your retail prices don't go up, you have a reduction in your profit margins. Sales are going to start to surprise like profits on the downside because there is a global economic slowdown, because growth of productivity is slowing down. Union labor costs are not falling anymore but rising as firms are starting to hire workers. And therefore, all factors suggest that there'll be a squeeze on profits, a squeeze on margins. And if that happens, then you have an equity market correction. If that equity market correction becomes more severe, like the spring of last year, through negative wealth effect, it's going to have a negative effect on investor confidence, on business confidence, on consumer confidence, lead to less investment, less consumption, and that may lead to a further leg down of slowdown of economic growth. They may lead again to concerns about stall speed, at a time where the problems of private and public debt have not been resolved. It happened a year ago exactly, where the trouble from Greece then led to bigger concerns about US stall speed and a slowdown with a massive correction, and it could happen this year again. And the difference between last year and this year was in the last two or three years, we had all the policy bullets. We could do monetary stimulus, we could do fiscal stimulus, we could backstop the banks when things were going wrong. Unfortunately, today, we're running out of policy bullets. Monetary policy is constrained because inflation, however slowly, is going up. Fiscal policy is constrained because countries are at the extreme of already being a bond market revolt, or if they do more fiscal stimulus, there will be a bond market revolt. And the ability of distressed governments that have already a pile of debt to backstop, bail out, and ring-fence their own financial system is much more limited because many, as I said, the banking risk became sovereign risk, and now the sovereign risk is going to become banking risk because the governments that are already up piled with debt are not going to be able to credibly backstop their own financial system. So 2 or 3 years ago, during the crisis, we had all the policy bullets, we've been using them year after year. If another stall speed were to occur, we're not going to have the monetary, the fiscal, and the backstopping options we had this time around before. That's why it's so important to try to follow the economic policies that gradually resolve our problems, because the safety net we had in the last few years is not going to be next time around. That's why the policy lesson for Romania, for Europe, for the US, for all economies in the world is try to follow the economic policies that are going to make you more resilient and more able to withstand contagion, because it's still a volatile world where there's lots of risk, lots of uncertainty, lots of tail events, lots of black swan events we've seen in the last few months, and therefore the best medicine and vaccine against that type of disease and contagion to have a sound body that is strong macroeconomic policies, financial, investing in the future, in growth of your economy and your competitiveness. There's no alternative to that, and that's the policy lesson that comes from the history of the last few years. Maybe I'll stop here, and thank you for your attention.